it's going to be fun to watch all the expectations that they have for him and what they expect. No tax on tips. Hey, when's that going to happen? No tax on overtime. No tax on Social Security. Hey, what happened to all those promises? Is any of that going to happen?
I think it's going to be about as likely as getting your degree in the mail from Trump University and any other, and pretending that Trump steaks are actually made of meat.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I am your host, as always, Rick Wilson. I am joined today by the great Ron Filipkowski, who is the editor-in-chief of Midas and a guy who always has his finger on the pulse of what's happening in American politics. I'm delighted to have him on the show today. Ron, I want to start out. You just wrote a piece about this post hoc analysis of the Harris campaign, and the big takeaway being that the Republicans, and we've talked about this a little bit on the show, but that Republicans have built this hermetic bubble, this alternative media ecosystem that nothing gets through. Talk to us about your conclusions on that and some of the reporting you're seeing on that. And then let's dig into, like, how do we counteract something like that?
There's a good answer to that. I watch, because I cover right-wing media. I cover this ecosystem and have for a long time. And I watched it develop organically. And it largely happened because so many of these people, including Donald Trump, were kicked off social media platforms because of COVID, January 6th, vaccine disinformation, insensitive language about race and gender. For a variety of reasons, thousands of them were kicked off traditional platforms. And what did they do? They created their own. They started their own podcasts, and they created this massive ecosystem where they can pump out their messaging and their lies to tens of millions of people every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why they have been so successful is because Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, and other leaders of the Republican Party promote these platforms. They go on small podcasts. Mm-hmm. Day after day, I would watch Trump do, in 2021, a podcast of a lady selling diet pills.
Sure.
Because he had 100,000 views on YouTube every episode. So mm-hmm. he's reaching low information voters, and promoting her show, helping her get new subscribers, new advertisers. The leaders of the Republican Party promote and advance and amplify alternative media. The leaders of the Democratic Party ignore it. They continue to go on CNN and MSNBC and give interviews to the Washington Post and think that they're reaching voters in Iowa, and they are not.
Correct. You know, that is, to me, one of the things that I keep coming back to in this election cycle is, you know, going on Joe Rogan and getting 50 million views is a real thing. Try getting 50 million eyeballs to watch an interview on any network. I mean, frankly, including Fox, but on any network. That is the kind of thing that I think has left us in this position where you can do one of two things. You can stare at the wall and go, oh shit, they've got this alternative media ecosystem, or you can get out and start building alternative media ecosystems that aren't driven by the older models of cable network news. Because I think one thing that we've learned in this country, and this is not a great thing, but one thing we've learned in this country is rigor and journalistic ethos and all of those things. They're important, but it's also got to be something that attracts eyeballs and attention and viewers, or you're going to get lost in the shuffle.
And I would watch not just Trump, but all Republican politicians do shows and podcasts that were not political. They were sports related. They were religious. They were diet. They were this. They were that. They were UFCs, you know, podcasts.
Yeah, sure.
And they're reaching. And by the way, they're not just waiting for 90 days before an election to do these, like so many
it's
Democrats.
All
do.
The time.
They're doing it year round, non-election years, all the time. And they're helping promote these people. And, you know, how about this? We make fun of Donald Trump all the time for reposting, retweeting, retruthing, whatever, all these obscure little accounts, memes, videos,
sure,
QAnon people. But you know what? You know, for all that we make fun of him, he's helping those people build their accounts, gain new followers. He himself is helping to build his own ecosystem by doing that. When was the last time Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Barack Obama retweeted some small account on Twitter and said, man, this is a really great take this person with 10,000 followers has? Never. It never happens. They are stuck in their elitist, bi-coastal, urban bubbles, and they don't venture out much. I don't know if it's because they don't want to condescend to do that. They don't have time or what, but look, we have a handful of Democratic politicians who do that. Eric Swalwell's, Adam Kinzinger, sure, from there. But we have a handful, AOC, who do that, but they're the younger ones, and it's only a small number of them.
It really is a recognition that the evolving media landscape in the country, take politics out of it, is going to be much, much, much less like the top-down network news model that, and frankly, it's going to look a lot, even, I was having a conversation this morning, actually, with somebody completely out of politics briefly, who said, you know, sports coverage is changing. It's not just ESPN and one and done anymore. It's everything's getting atomized and spread out, and these new platforms that are influencing how people get news, get sports, get entertainment. All of it has so diffuse now that and I think that is a failure mode of the Democrats. It's like, well, we have an editorial in the New York Times about it. Haven't you read it? You know, and that's not selling the American people anymore.
Look, Stephen A. Smith, ESPN.
Yeah.
Just inked a $120 million contract extension for his show, right? Yeah. Just gave one of the worst takes on January 6th I have seen anywhere. And it went hugely viral. Where? On right-wing media and right-wing social media. They took his one-minute clip and blew it up. And he gave a very bad take on the new DOJ IG report talking about the FBI's use of informants. It was, I thought, an ignorant take. And right-wingers blew it up. But the point is, that take reached a message, reached an audience of millions of people who are not political people. They're sports people. And he reached them with right-wing disinformation. And he's not a Republican. And so this is yet another, and I called him out on it, and his producer contacted me this morning and invited me on his show. So I'm one of the kinds of things that we have to fight back on this kind of stuff, because these are the battles we're losing.
You're right, and I hadn't thought about that. I thought about a lot about the distribution model, but the promotion model on the right, they are very attuned to instantaneously saying, good message, no matter who it is, or knowing that a message will be sufficiently viral and controversial and making it into something that for their own purposes. I think that's a really important observation, because a lot of this does come down to the fact that nothing in the right-wing bubble that is useful politically is ever ignored.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. It's amplified, it's promoted, retweeted, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, you know, we have Democrats who are like, don't tweet that person. Don't use that word. I don't want to see that person's face. So it's like we have negative incentives on the left among Democrats to put this kind of information out, because so many of them don't want to hear it, and they reject it. And so I just think the solution is for the people in charge of the Democratic Party, the most senior elected officials, you know, the governors, the Gavin Newsoms, the Josh Shapiros, to go on obscure podcasts, to give interviews to people on Substack, you know, instead of just the New York Times, to be sources for them, to feed them information, text the writers, text the editors. Right-wingers do this. They network constantly. They have conferences, CPAC, you know, Turning Point USA. Democrats have none of these things. This is why they're losing.
I was recording something else this morning, a different podcast, and I talked about it. I was like, there have been the reason that people have in some ways lost faith in the media is in part because there was a war on the media. And guys like me, when I was on the right, when I was in the Republican world, you know, I would call reporters, I would call editors, I would yell at them, how dare you say this? How dare you? Or I would say, hey, guess what I'm hearing? You know what I got? And I think an awful lot of people, the most broken ass thing that I've discovered about a lot of folks in the Democratic progressive side, there is still this belief like, oh, we sent them a press statement. We sent them a press release. What the fuck are you talking about? It's the year of our Lord 2024. What?
You know what? I remember something that illustrated that point very vividly. You remember when the gas prices spiked, you know, after COVID in 2021, and Republicans, and this was organized through social media, were putting these stickers on the gas pumps, the Joe Biden stickers saying, I did that, where Biden is pointing. And they would put it next to the gas price on the pump, like gas stations all over America. And for weeks and months, I was complaining on social media saying, what is the administration doing to counter this very simple, foolish, little silly message, but the message that's working? What are we doing? And finally, after like 3 months, they put out a 14-point bullet point policy paper as to why gas prices went up. And I'm like, no one is ever going to read that. There's going to be 12 people in you know, Manhattan who are going to read that. You know,
right.
And so it's this. They have a simple message. It's a direct message. They pump it out. They pump it out day after day, whether it's gas prices, baby formula, or migrant crime. And, you know, Democrats issue press releases to the New York Times.
It is a striking reflection of you know, as my friend Trinity Olson always says, you know, fight the battle you're in, not the one you want to be in. You know, fight the fight you're actually in, not the fight you think you're in. And I do think there's a certain level of nostalgia for a world of media and a world of communications that is something the Democratic Party really needs to shake and shake quickly. They're not going to get back to the thing where someone goes on CNN and they discuss their 600-page plan for whatever it is, climate change or whatever. None of it's going to be, I don't think none of that's coming back. None of that, well, that's a rear view thing in the country. And I'm curious, in part, the presence on the right of, you know, of Elon Musk's Twitter, where they say, oh, citizen journalism, which is not either journalism or citizens for the most part, but that's another story for another day. When they start talking about stuff like that, and you look at it, and you're like, is this something that there's any countervailing force on? I mean, we're all in blue sky now on the social media front, and Threads and other platforms. But I'm curious about like how much of the mediation of today's information flow is going to end up going through Twitter itself, which I think is a fundamentally flawed and broken platform now, or do you see any other pathways where people should be paying more attention?
Yeah. I mean, you're right about Twitter and you're right about Musk. And I think that's a broken platform that's never going to be the answer. I mean, we can stay on there and continue to fight, but the problem with a platform like Blue Sky, which Republicans now call Blue Cry, is you know, the sensitivity level is so high on that platform. You can't post a photo of Donald Trump. Forget about posting a clip of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You can't post a photo of a Republican or a clip of a Republican without getting backlash. And this is something that I am constantly fighting with my own followers about in terms of trying to say, You can't be so sensitive. You can't wall yourself off from reality if you're going to be involved in politics. You can't be so sensitive that you can't handle watching a 12-second clip of Donald Trump. You know, so we have to sort of build up, we have to educate our people. And I think I have done that with so many followers of mine that I've convinced them that they need to pay attention to what is happening in the Republican Party, and they can't stick their head in their sand and ignore it. So I don't know if Blue Sky can become that. I just think it has to be a very diverse system where it's some Substack, it's some podcast, it's some social, because that's what the right is. The right is a very diverse universe, kaleidoscope of platforms, and whether it's social media platform, Truth Social, or whatever, it's very diverse. And the Democratic side is not diverse in terms of the way it's delivering information.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So I do want to give people a little bit of optimism in the world sometimes, and it's important for us to not look at the Republicans as being all powerful political supermen. And one of the things you were writing about just today was Victoria Spartz, one of the craziest of the Republican caucus, has now said she's not going to serve on committees and caucus on committees. She's going to try. She and Thomas Massie are going to try to be rebels inside the Republican Party and help Trump and Doge. So Mike Johnson is sitting on top of a very, 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 very small majority right now. Talk to us a little bit about your reporting and your observations of how the restive nature of the hyper Trump caucus is at sort of a gun to the head of Mike Johnson's ability to govern it.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm really following that closely, especially with the CR vote, you know, this week, which is really with Spucks. The biggest problem that the Republican Party has is they all hate each other. You know, they either hate each other or they're rivals. And it's a constant battle within the party with each other. They are always attacking each other every single day. So the Victoria Spartz thing, I think the best reporting that I saw on that I thought that was most accurate was that she really wanted to be on Ways and Means and didn't get it. And she threw this temper tantrum where she just said, that's it. I'm not showing up to any meetings. I'm not going to any committees. I'm not doing anything. I'm going to stay as a Republican in name only, basically, is what she's saying. And I'm only going to talk to Thomas Massie, who's a rather unpleasant person to talk to.
Who's really a bad guy, folks. If you think you know some bad guys in the House, Thomas Massie's like in the peak of the pyramid of the bad guys in the House.
He's like the only guy who never endorsed Donald Trump. He's the only one, like a Republican member of Congress who's never endorsed Trump.
Right.
You know, he's just this weird guy. But, you know, that's the point, is that they all... Oh, and the CR, so many of them are sniping at Mike Johnson because, look, what was a big complaint they had against Pelosi? You didn't let us read the bill.
Right.
And they promised. Johnson promised, I will not put anything up for a vote until you've had 72 hours to read the bill. Well, they're all fighting over the CR because they're trying to make it an omnibus where they're trying to add a bunch of stuff to it instead of just passing a clean CR and keeping the government open for another 90 days. They're playing games with it, and you're getting a rebellion. You're getting all these people that are complaining. Number one, they're not going to get 72 hours to read this thing. As of, 8 o'clock this morning, it still wasn't out. The government shuts down Friday.
And there's also this moment where the Trump team and the Senate, they want to do this two-track, two-tier approach. They want to get a quick kill on an immigration, border security, blah, 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 and then come back to the tax bill later. And in the House, there are a lot of these people like, give us all of it, make it the omnibus, do the whole thing, give us our wish list, do all of it at once, which I don't think can pass the Senate as of right now.
The people in the farm districts want all kinds of farm pork and subsidies. Mm-hmm. Ronnie Jackson was yelling about this yesterday, and others. You have the people in North Carolina want disaster relief money in there.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody has something that they want. And this is exactly what Mike Johnson said he wasn't going to do, is allow all these things to get attached to spending bills. I mean, look, they promised to do the budget as 14 separate appropriations bills instead of putting one budget up for vote. And they've never been able to get that done. They passed a handful, but not enough for a complete budget. So we're still continuing with Nancy Pelosi's budget into 2025.
For now, folks, and it may change. For now, folks, Congress still has to pass bills. They still have to have the House and the Senate agree on how that spending in those bills is allocated and directed. I think there are going to be a lot of Trump supporters, Ron. I want to get your feeling on this. I think a lot of Trump supporters are going to be disappointed that the imagined miracles that they thought were going to come the minute he walked back in the door, we're going to deport 25 million people, we're going to shut the borders, we're going to put down 100% tariffs on all the people we don't like, all these things. I think they don't understand that he was bullshitting them and that it's literally not possible. And folks, members of Congress, when you start to come into their district and say, we're going to kill X or Y program, they love Donald Trump, but they love those jobs and that money in their district more than life itself. So how do you think that's the disappointment people are going to experience on the Trump side? I mean, they've always been flexible about, like, you know, giving Trump credit for things he doesn't do. But I think they're going to end up in a position where they're not going to be as happy as they think they are.
Their expectations are way higher now than they were in 2017 for what they're going to get out of Trump. And that's why I wrote an article right after the election of 92 specific campaign promises on policy that Trump made on video, and we archived each one,
right,
at Linus, each promise. And some of these things were completely outlandish and outrageous, and he's never mentioned them since 2023, but he still promised them on video in all these policy videos. So just take the migrant thing, for example. I mean, what do we know? First of all, 25% of the construction workers in the United States are deportable migrants. 25%. And there's another 25% of construction jobs in the U.S. that remain unfilled. Now, who is running these construction companies? Largely Republicans.
Republicans.
Trump donors. So are you telling me that Trump is going to deport 400,000 construction workers from Republican CEO-owned companies? I mean,
good luck.
What's going to happen? And so he's already walking back what he's going to do in that area. Like, well, we're going to start with the criminals first. The criminals are already sitting in prison with holds on them to be deported. So what are you going to send them back home before they finish their sentences? It's going to be fun to watch all the expectations that they have for him and what they expect. No tax on tips. Hey, when's that going to happen? No tax on overtime. No tax on Social Security. Hey, what happened to all those promises? Is any of that going to happen?
I think it's going to be about as likely as getting your degree in the mail from Trump University and any other, and pretending that Trump steaks are actually made of meat. I mean, The whole thing strikes me as this.
Kim and Don and Junior are going to get married.
Oh man, if those two star-crossed lovers can't make it, who can? You know, that sending her up to Greece, where now she's going to either be she'll be in Greece almost as far away as you could get her from Donald Trump Jr. As ambassador, and she'll either find a shipping magnate or a local goat herd. You know, as her new lama.
Spend a lot of time on Santorini, not so much Athens.
Right. So who are you looking at in the new administration that's going to be, that you think is going to generate the most amazing and ridiculous content?
Ooh. I mean, I think the least controversial is going to be Rubio. But, you know, I wonder, because you look at all the people that Trump is appointing under Rubio, and I can't see Rubio liking or getting along with Rick Grenell. You know, like,
listen, Michael Anton worked for me at one point. I cannot, and I know Marco, I cannot for a minute imagine Marco and Rick Grenell and Michael Anton and the various weirdos that are being shoved into the State Department, which really does seem to be like a sort of gravity well for a lot of the sort of, you know, alt-right reactionary types for in Trump's administration. I can't imagine how that's going to work. I know the guy that's going to be his chief of staff, not a crazy person. And I'm curious how they're going to manage to hive off those people, because for all my critique of Marco, he is a serious person at some level and does understand foreign policy at some level.
Yep.
I mean, he may be Rex Tillerson 2.0.
But the people underneath him, I don't think agree with him on a lot of things.
Correct.
You know, I think most of the action, though, is going to come out of DOJ. You know, I think it's going to be, you know, your Pam Bondi, Kash Patel, mm-hmm. if he gets confirmed. I mean, if you, Kash Patel as FBI director and Pam Bondi as AG, that's where, because Trump wants, no matter what he's saying, he wants retribution and he wants DOJ to go after his enemies and others. And I think that, to me, like, I'm watching that. I'm also watching tariff waivers, which is something that not a lot of people are talking about. But these billionaires are piling up and going down to Mar-a-Lago for a reason.
Yeah, why do you think Tim Cook is at Mar-a-Lago?
Yeah, the Netflix CEO is there right now, I think. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they all want something, of course. They all want a variety of different things, but what I think Trump is going to do with tariffs is he's going to impose a lot of these tariffs, but then basically the carve-outs, the waivers to these tariffs are going to be sold to the highest bidder mm-hmm. on a company-by-company basis.
I think that's right. And that's
he's
right.
He's going to be selling tariff waivers like he sold pardons.
You know, I want to go back to DOJ for a second. And folks, there's a scene in The Godfather where one of the characters looks over and says, I'm going to speak Italian to Michael for a second. Ron and I are going to speak Italian for a second here about Florida. Knowing Pam Bondi, which both of us have observed her in Florida politics, the idea that Pam Bondi is going to be the responsible one in the DOJ with Kash Patel as the FBI director blows my damn mind. Pam is someone who combines, she's not super smart. She's not stupid, but she's not super smart. But she has worked for a major lobbyist, Trump's favorite lobbyist, a guy named Brian Ballard for a long time. She's conflicted up the wall with so many contracts with Qatar and pharma and everyone else under the sun. I mean, look, I think she's going to get confirmed, but talk to us a little bit about where you see that dynamic between Bondi and Patel, because even Pam Bondi is going to have to go, oh, Cash, no, man. Stop it. Even Pam Bondi.
You know, I am someone who has probably watched more Kash Patel interviews than any Democrat. You know,
I'm so sorry.
I watched him on all these podcasts that we were talking about at the beginning of the show. Hundreds of them. He would go on everything because he had all kinds of products that he was selling, knickknacks and trinkets, as he was hanging down at Mar-a-Lago as Devin Nunes' right-hand man trying to run True Social. And he was selling all his products and doing all these podcasts. And the reason why I paid attention to him was because they kept saying over and over again on these shows that he was going to be either CIA director or FBI director. And while a lot of people made fun of that and mocked that at the time, I took it seriously because there were too many people saying it. And I knew that he was moved into Mar-a-Lago basically and was tight with Nunes. And I figured, you know, he's going to get something significant. And this man is absolutely bonkers, crazy. He's a lunatic. And the thing about his resume is, if you look at his resume on paper, it looks impressive because he's got a lot of titles on there. But then you dig into it, like he claims to have been the lead prosecutor of Benghazi. And like the prosecutors who were actually the lead prosecutors say, he was like the fourth guy in the corner of the room that nobody listened to.
But, right.
You know, he's got that he was chief of staff to the Secretary of Defense. Well, that was when Esper was fired
for about
Chris
5 minutes.
Was appointed as acting chief, and then Kash Patel was appointed as his acting chief of staff. So he was acting chief of staff to the acting Secretary of Defense for a month.
Right.
But yet he has this thing on his resume that looks great, you know?
You know, it really strikes me. It really strikes me all the time that the idea that these people that these people, they hate government. They hate government service. And yet they always want to look at it and say, well, no, they're qualified. We're so qualified.
I mean, Kash Patel said that the FBI building should be shut down, closed, and all of the agents to be sent home that are in the FBI headquarters building. He said it should be disbanded. And he just got nominated to be the director. I mean, and the Secretary of Education wants to disband the Department of Education. So he's appointing people to these positions who want to dismantle and destroy the agencies that they're being appointed to run.
Nothing can be proved or nothing can be expected going forward, but more chaos, folks. And one of the best observers out there is Ron Filipkowski. Follow him on Substack on Midas Plus. He is on Twitter, swinging the axe every day at the bad guys. My friend, thank you so much for coming on the show today. We will talk again very soon.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joseph Wardner-Cheney. Produced and edited by Whitney Hayes and Jeff Taylor.
And good luck.
Hey, everybody. If you would like to get in touch, if you have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just general questions, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. That's podcast@lincolnproject.us.